on The Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's our great privilege to welcome back to On The Bookshelf, Ace Collins, a longtime guest on The Bookshelf, and we're going to talk today about four books that I have reviewed over the past, amazingly enough, 10 years that all have Christmas in the title or all have Christmas stories to tell, and a book which somehow I missed that we're going to mention anyway, the prolific author, Ace Collins. All of these books are from Zondervan Publishing House. They are Stories Behind the Best Love Songs of Christmas, More Stories Behind the Best Love Songs of Christmas, Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas, 25 Days, 26 Ways to Make This Your Best Christmas Ever. And that came out in 2009. And last year's, what was the name of last year's book, Ace?
Stories Behind the Greatest Hits of Christmas.
I will say that one of the things I've enjoyed about reviewing your books through the years, not just these, but also others that you've written, is that I always learn something interesting about songs that I've enjoyed for a long, long time. And sometimes I also learn about songs that I've never heard of before. And after I read the backstories to them, I think, man, I have got to find this song somehow because, wow, what a great story it has. And that in particular reminds me of the story of Al Burt. And this is, there are three stories about him in the More Stories Behind the Best Love Songs of Christmas. So would you tell me about Al Burt and how he came to be a Christmas songwriter and what makes his story particularly interesting for it?
Well, Al Burt, and he's probably best remembered for the song he wrote that Nat King Cole has got a seasonal hit on, Caroling, Caroling, As We Go, da 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 da, you know, it's a song that we all know, we hear every year. It was actually Nat King Cole's follow up to It's a Christmas Song, you know, which Mel Torme wrote, Chestnuts Roasting in an Open Fire. And so, you know, but Burt himself got locked into a tradition that began in 1843. And that tradition that began in 1843 was when Sir Henry Cole was overwhelmed by the correspondence he'd received. And during Victorian times, it was rude not to answer every mail, piece of mail you got. And so what he did was he had commissioned an artist to create a Christmas scene. Actually, it was a dinner scene around the table. And he had that printed on cardstock and sent that out to his friends as the very first Christmas greeting card. Well, that spawned an industry. Well, the Burt family, starting with Albert's dad, every year did something. This dad was a preacher. Every year they did something that was really special. They would create a new Christmas song. And this happened before Al was writing. And they would create this Christmas song, and his father would send it out to all of his friends at Christmas as their Christmas card. Well, when Al became a proficient musician, played in band at Michigan State, did the other things that were involved with being a musician, started creating songs, arranging songs, his dad passed along the job to him to write these Christmas songs. Ultimately, he would put these out. They would go out, people would get them, sometime they would be sung, but he never actually figured they would ever be recorded. And then a man who we're very familiar with named Ralph Carmichael, a Christian songwriter who has produced and arranged so many different songs that I guess really he was on the forefront of the contemporary Christian movement, got a hold of some of Burt's songs, and he got a hold of them after Burt had died of cancer in 1933. And he actually waited and waited and waited outside Nat King Cole's office to get Cole to listen to Caroling, Caroling. And then Cole listened. Then he took it to Tennessee Ernie Ford, who listened to the Star Carol. And what you had was a man who, in his brief life of 33 years before he died of cancer, went on to really change and shape the world and the way they listened to Christmas music. He would change, by the way, every year he would write a different style Christmas song as well. One time it would be caroling, kind of a contemporary feel to it, not necessarily spiritual. The next year it would be a deeply spiritual song, like Son's Children See Him, which is my favorite Burt carol.
Yes, yeah,
and when you listen to this music, you hear this man who understood not only the Christmas of Christ's birth, but also all of the traditions and the joy that came from experiencing this Christmas for 2, 3, 4 weeks. You know, a great man died like more than 60 years ago now, and you think about him and the effect that he's still having, it's quite a testament for a man who was never discovered when he was alive. to suddenly be discovered now. By the way, the Star Carol, the last song he wrote, he finished on Christmas Eve, just before his death, and went outside for the last time with a clear sky and everything, and thought about the song that he had just finished, and asked his wife. He said, please don't let my music die. And this lady was the one who found Ralph Carmichael and didn't let that music die, and that music, therefore, has touched millions of people ever since. It's really, in some ways, a great testament to the greatest story ever told, because here's some of the greatest music ever written telling that story.
Absolutely. Ace Collins, our guest today on The Bookshelf for Christmas time, and we're looking at his five different books that center on Christmas and stories about Christmas traditions, Christmas carols. Charles Wesley, we'll go back almost 300 years, Charles Wesley is considered one of the most prolific songwriters of the English language, wrote somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 hymns. We're not sure exactly how many, because not all of them.
I was saying about 20 or 30 a day. That's pretty remarkable.
Absolutely. One of the most popular of his Christmas carols is Hark the Herald Angels Sing. He also wrote Come Thou Long Expected Jesus, which is a pretty cool song, too. But he's not the only guy who's fairly famous that wrote Christmas music. I think personally the most interesting, as much as I'm a Methodist, so of course I like Charles Wesley, but I think particularly a song that was not written to be a Christmas carol, but now is considered to be one of the most popular Christmas carols, was written by another prolific songwriter about the same time, Isaac Watts. That's based on a psalm and was not originally intended to be a Christmas carol. So tell us the story of Joy to the World.
Isaac Watts is an interesting fellow. We owe him so much because he was kind of bold. When he was a teenager, his dad was a minister, and he came out of church one day, and he's sitting around the dinner table, and he told his dad, "Your services are boring." And you can imagine that maybe in a contemporary society, but let's go back 400 years and imagine somebody saying that to your father back then, who's a pastor. He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "We sing the same psalms every week." And they did. They literally sang out of the book of Psalms. He said, "We only have six different tunes we sing these things to. You know, it's boring. It's boring. It's boring. You see people falling asleep during the music." His dad looked at him and said, "Well, Isaac, if you think it's so bad, then and you think it could be changed, then do it yourself." And Isaac went out and wrote his first hymn. You know, 800 or 900 hymns later, you know, he changed the way we look at music, because not only did he create new music for hymns, but he took us out of the Old Testament and placed us into the New Testament. He began to write hymns that evolved into something that was remarkable. It's a very first-person view of God. Before that, it was a very corporate view, and Psalms were a part of that, but it was history. It wasn't new. It wasn't realized. It wasn't, you know, this joyous time of the present where people of today were expressing how they felt about God, in this case, Christmas. Joy to the World, therefore, jumped out of that. And when you think about Joy to the World, I think it's one of the most remarkable Christmas songs written, because it's universally known. I mean, you can't even go through a mall without hearing Joy to the World. I mean, you know, it's everywhere this time of year. And joy, I think largely because of that song, is also on Christmas cards. It's hanging in windows, it's in yards. It really is a part of the season, you know, the joyous Noel. I think joy really, therefore, came about because of this song. And I think Watts was just brilliant in creating this thought of joy to the world. And yet he actually based it to a large degree on the prophecy of Jesus coming rather than the gospel story himself, looking ahead to that joy. Lowell Mason, I believe, was the man, and I have to go back and look at my notes, but Lowell Mason was the man who actually gave us the new music for it that we sing with it today. And I don't think it's quite, you know, I was talking to people the other day, and I was asking the question, what song do you hear before it's Christmas? What song do you have to hear every year before it's Christmas? And most of the songs that people said, even though this was a church setting, most people listed songs that were songs that had been written in the last probably 60, 70, 80 years, and were not necessarily sacred carols. They were secular carols. But Joy to the World was one of those songs that got mentioned, that and Silent Night, more than any other of the two carols that we sing each year. And by the way, Silent Night to me has been, if not the greatest, the second greatest story behind the writing of that song of any possibly any song that was ever written, because we should not know Silent Night.
And right.
Yet it is the most, it is the Jesus Loves Me of Christmas songs. It is the most sung, not necessarily the most recorded, but it is the most sung and the widest known of all of the carols that have ever been, the thousands upon thousands of carols that have ever been penned.
And it spread all across Europe before anybody knew who'd actually written it.
That's one of the great things about this story, because, you know, one of the things when you're doing research, and I was explaining this to somebody the other day, it's separating legend from fiction, you know, because you've got a legend thing going on, you've got the fiction going on here, and then you've got the fact. Where do you separate those three things? And when you get stories that have been passed down from generation to generation, it's tough. Most people now think of Silent Night and think of this priest who, when the organ didn't work because the mice had eaten the bellows, this young priest got together with a school teacher and they wrote a song. Well, that's not entirely true. One, the mice didn't eat the bellows, but the organ was old. And on Christmas Eve, when this young priest, who was just 21 years old, discovered the organ wouldn't work and he was in charge of the service, he panicked and went to his best friend, Franz Gruber, the teacher. Gruber calmed the guy down and said, "We've got to do something else for it." He said, "I can play guitar." And he said, "None of my songs that I picked out for the service go with guitar." He said, "Well, we'll do something else." And that is when Moore, the priest, remembered a poem he had written some years before when he was visiting his uncle. Now, most of us come up with creative ideas and we don't write them down. This is a great example of why you need to write things down.
Right.
He wrote down this poem, and not only that, he kept it. And he went back to his little place where he lived and dug through his drawers until he found that poem, and he and Gruber wrote the music for Silent Night to save the Christmas Eve service. That should have been the only place we ever heard it, except the organ was broke. And what happens when an organ is broke at a church? Somebody has to come fix it. And that somebody who was a specialist came in from about 3 or 4 weeks later, and one of the questions he asked the priest, Moore, "What did you do for music?" Moore picked up the guitar that he had borrowed from the school teacher and played the song. The organ engineer, fixer, whatever you want to call him, wrote down the lyrics to Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, Silent Night, Holy Night, and the music. And the next 30 years, everywhere he went to fix an organ, he taught that song. Imagine Moore, who is now a middle-aged to old man, walking by a church one day and hearing this song that he penned in a panic with his friend, created in a panic with his friend, coming from this grand cathedral. And realize other people do it. And so here's the song that had been passed all over Europe, and the priest who invented it didn't even realize that it had ever been used other than that one service in that little church in Austria because the organ didn't work. And by the way, what was the name of the church? Saint Nicholas.
You couldn't make this stuff up.
When
could
I found
you?
Out the name of the church, I couldn't believe it was Saint Nicholas. You know?
Wow. Very cool. We are talking to Ace Collins, the author of 5 different books on Christmas, including Stories Behind the Best Loved Songs of Christmas, More Stories Behind the Best Loved Songs of Christmas, Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas. I've got them all spread out here, see. 26 Ways to Make This Your Best Christmas Ever. And Ace, what was the name of last year's book?
Stories Behind the Greatest Hits of Christmas. We got an opportunity, therefore, last year to, it's amazing. I do probably 300 or 400 radio interviews a year, and a lot of them are call-in shows where people ask, what's the story behind such and such? And I would take notes on what people wanted the stories behind that we hadn't written the stories behind yet. And what we did was, when in the hits book, we went back and found what were the 30 biggest radio hits of all time. And actually it was publishing hits too, because we predated radio with some of the stuff in the early 1900s, but the publishing and radio hits, the biggest selling songs of the holidays, and found the stories behind them and put them in the book. And it was really interesting to see where those stories came from and why those songs lasted and were famous. It's surprising. I mean, it really is. Songs, and literally speaking, probably this year we'll have 50 or 60 new Christmas songs that'll be recorded and they'll be introduced on iTunes and radio and other places.
Yeah.
And why do certain ones last and other ones don't? And I think if you look, it's the traumatic times people are going through when those songs come out, because those songs make an impact on these people at Christmas time that is, even if they're a secular song, has a spiritual impact that goes with it. Think of World War II. On Christmas Eve, 1941, Bing Crosby on national radio sang a song that was from a movie he was working on that wasn't even going to come out till the following summer. The name of the movie was Holiday Inn. But Bing felt moved to sing White Christmas that night because it was 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor had been attacked. Right. The United States had been plunged into war. And he felt of all the things that he knew, possibly this song would resonate with an America that was suddenly very unsure and very shaken. And it did. And I think when that song was introduced is why that song became so famous. Christmas Eve, 1941, America's at war, and the first new Christmas song they hear is White Christmas. And yeah. It becomes almost a type of bond that unites those who are leaving to go fight the war with those who are home, and those who are over in the jungles in the Pacific or the cold battlegrounds in Europe are dreaming, literally, of a white Christmas when they get back home. The very next year, Bing Crosby introduced another Christmas song that resonates still, and that's I'll Be Home for Christmas. Why did it work? It's only 12 lines long. It was written by two different men, and ironically enough, three different men get the credit for it because another man, Buck Rand, had gotten the idea for the song and shared the idea with two friends who were songwriters. They created the song. All three of them shared in the rewards of writing it. But I'll Be Home for Christmas was also, if you think about it, a prayer.
Yeah.
And that prayer was something that resonated very strongly, I think, because we were in a world war. And I think those two songs by Bing Crosby became as well-known and beloved as they are today because of when they were introduced. The other one is Judy Garland's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Right, which came from a movie that had nothing particularly to do with Christmas.
No, maybe in St. Louis. I mean, you know, and she sang it. And really, at the point in time when she sang it, she was looking at leaving the person that she loved because her family was supposed to move. And so it was a very, very sad time for her. It was a time when her character was losing the love of her life. And yet Judy looked at the words of this song, and they fit perfectly. You know, this may be our Christmas last. Next year we might be living in the past. Those were two lines from that song that were supposed to be in there that she refused to sing. She sent it back to the songwriter and said, you got to rewrite it. We can't give out this kind of message at a time when millions of families are separated by war.
Yeah,
they've got to have something to hold on to. They rewrote it with upbeat lyrics, and maybe the upbeat lyrics weren't as strong with the song in the movie, but it became that third giant hit of World War II. And ironically enough, we think of Judy Garland as being this incredible recording star, and yet she only charted a few times in her entire life.
Right.
You know, her two biggest hits were this song and the song that she had, you know, as a teenager in Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Dinah Shore that had over 300 chart records. Judy Garland had a handful, but Dinah Shore never hit that classic Christmas song, so we've pretty much forgotten Dinah Shore now.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
But we can't forget. I mean, think about this now. This is so unique when you think about Christmas. I call Christmas music a time machine, and Christmas ornaments are the same way. But they take us back every year to a place in our past. It brings to life people that we've lost. I can't look at a blue light on a Christmas tree because I have one tree in our house that has blue lights. Can't look at a blue light on a Christmas tree without thinking about my grandmother because she always had blue lights on her tree. Suddenly, she's very alive, and suddenly, I'm 5 or 6 or 9 or 10 years old. I'm in Salem, Arkansas again.
Yeah.
So music has that same effect. It takes us back to a particular moment in time for us. And therefore, Christmas music that becomes a hit comes back to us each and every year. And we hear that artist again. Dinah Shore, one of the greatest female artists of all time, never had a Christmas hit. Hence, most people today who are younger than baby boomers have no idea who Dinah Shore is, but they
right.
listen to Judy Garland every year. They listen to Bing Crosby every year. They listen to another man, the singing barber, Perry Como, every year because of Christmas music. They know them.
There's another song that came about as a direct result of someone's experience in a war situation. It's one of my very favorite Christmas songs, and that is...
I know where you're headed with this one.
Yeah, Longfellow's I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day.
Yeah, Longfellow was so depressed during the Civil War because so many of his students, he was a professor. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, American professor besides being a poet, he made his real living teaching school. as so many of the great artists did, they really did have daytime jobs. And he was caught in a situation where so many of his students were leaving, and not just leaving for the Civil War, but were being killed in the Civil War or being badly maimed. Their lives were being turned upside down. His wife, who he loved dearly, had an accident with a candle. Her gown caught on fire, and she died. His own son was badly injured during the war. Christmas morning, he gets up, he opens his windows, he listens to the church bells ringing, and he has this incredible wave of sadness that overcomes him. He had been depressed for weeks. Christmas depressed him even more. I heard the bells on Christmas Day, their old familiar carols play. But what are the words that we think of when we sing that song? He is singing about the depths of depression. He's singing that there's no hope. He's singing that it has been lost. He's singing that Christmas doesn't mean anything anymore because the world is at war. And yet you look at those lyrics and you let those lyrics play through. And yes, that first few verses talks about, "And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men." And that after a while, though, he continues to listen to those bells, and suddenly hope comes forth. "And then pealed the bells more loud and clear. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. Till singing on its way, the world revolve from night to day. A voice of chime, a chant sublime, of peace on earth, goodwill to men." Here was a man who, in the midst of depression, heard the church bells. They made him more depressed initially, and then changed his darkness into light. I guess it fits in this particular case. It's always darkest before the dawn, because the dawn woke him up to the faith that he once had and opened up the world of hope and promise of the future that had been lost before he heard those church bells. Amazing song. And another one that really has a similar story is the song of "Do You Hear What I Hear?" Because a man named Noel, who had been in concentration camps in World War II, had seen his country in France decimated by the war, came to the United States trying to escape all the nightmares of his existence, where he'd lost his family and everyone else, walked into a hotel and saw someone playing piano at the hotel. He was entranced by the way she played. He spoke no English. She spoke no French. Yet somehow they got to know each other, and they got married, and they became a songwriting team. And then the Vietnam War came about, and suddenly Noel became depressed again. And he sat down and he wrote the song, "Do You Hear What I Hear?" And he wrote it really as much as anything else, wanting war to end, wanting to, kind of like a child holding his hands over his ears, hoping the loud noise will go away. He never dreamed when he wrote it that it would become this monster hit. He never dreamed even that his wife would be able to set it to music and do something very special with it. Yet here's the song that was so powerful when it came out in the early 60s that there were newspaper reports that I've read of people pulling off to the side of the road just to listen to the words. You know, and I mentioned a while ago that Silent Night was written, you know, and was first performed in a church named St. Nicholas. Mm-hmm. The songwriters, the husband and wife songwriters, that couldn't speak each other's language when they met and fell in love, names were Noel and Gloria. And so you're in a situation where, you know, you got to see that there's something working behind the scenes here, bringing these people together to create this magic.
Now,
that's part of Christmas.
There's one more song I wanted. I know we just have a few minutes left, but that's a song that came about toward the end of the Vietnam War. It was a time of 1970 was a year of transition. And this is a song with connections to St. Olaf College, I think it was. That's "Merry Christmas, Darling."
Yeah. Actually, the lyrics were written right after World War II. It was written by a man who had a summer crush on, St. Olaf is correct, and he was actually staying at a lake in Minnesota. A young lady lived there, this young student was, who was going to St. Olaf, and he fell in love with her in a kind of college sort of way, and when they no longer could be together and were going to have to leave, he wrote a Christmas poem for her, created music to go with it. Well, he forgot about that. and forgot about her, and he moved on. And she probably forgot about him, too. It's one of those nice little summer loves, like, that you hear about, you know, Sealed with a Kiss and all those other songs that were popular in the 1950s and 1960s. Well, what ultimately happened, though, is this man became a professor and began to teach a young man that he considered a genius, and that man was Richard Carpenter. And Carpenter came to him. He had the Carpenter Trio at the time with another young man and his sister Karen. And they were performing in little local venues, mostly Holiday Inns and stuff like that. And he said, I need some Christmas music. Do you have any? And the guy said, you know, guess what? Now, here's a man who's in his 40s now. The love affair has been long forgotten. I've got this song I wrote for an old girlfriend. But the music's not very good. Why don't you take it? Richard took it in about a... just a literally an hour or two, wrote the music for Merry Christmas, Darling. Within a year, he and Karen and the Carpenters had become hits, and they became so strong that their recording label, A&M, needed some Christmas music for them, and they were performing this live anyway, so they hurried back into the studio in the middle of the summer to cut this song. And I think it became probably... I was in college in the 70s. I think it became probably the greatest... secular Christmas song introduced possibly since those great songs during World War II.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I mean, it was a song that resonated with, seemingly with every age group. I have a 1959 Horlitzer jukebox in my house, and I fill it with Christmas music every year. And every Sunday night, we have about 30 college kids that we feed over here that come from the two universities here in the town where we live. And that's one of the songs that gets plugged all the time this time of year in the jukebox. Those kids still love Merry Christmas, Darling. And yeah. I think... you know, that's one of those songs that people have to hear at Christmas, along with Bing Crosby's White Christmas and Perry Como's It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas and Nat King Cole's The Christmas Song and Elvis's Blue Christmas. I think Merry Christmas, Darling is one of those 10 songs that people have to hear every year. And I think we identify with it because we all want to be with the people we love during the holidays.
Right. Ace Collins, our guest today, talking about his five Christmas books that have come out over the last 10 years. A new Christmas novel coming out next year. The previous five came out from Zondervan Publishing House, and I'm thinking you could check their website, zondervan.com, or Ace, can they check your website?
They can actually read sample chapters on my website, and for the books, they can, and I always recommend to people, and you've heard me on your program before, recommend to people that they buy them from either local booksellers or online sellers because they can get them cheaper than they can for me. I have to pay the full price, so by the time you add shipping and stuff like that to it, all I'm doing is putting my name in it. You know, you can get it cheaper somewhere else, so save yourself some money at Christmas and buy them from somewhere else, but you can test drive them. You can read sample chapters on my website of all five of those books.
Wonderful.
And then next year from Abingdon, we've got a book called The Christmas Star that comes out. And we're going to do a series of novels set at Christmas each and every year. And next year marks the first one, and it's set right after World War II.
Okay. Well, we'll be talking again before too long then. Ace, right. It's always great to get a chance to talk to you. It's wonderful to pull out these books that still have so much wonderful information and such written with such great heart. Delighted to hear that they continue to be in print.
And I am blessed because now the Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas is even being printed in Chinese and sold on the Chinese mainland. So
wow.
The word's getting out, and it's funny that these books can carry that message all around the globe.
Absolutely. Ace Collins, our guest again this year on the bookshelf. Thank you so much, Ace, for being with us, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and mighty Christmas to y'all.
We hope you've enjoyed this encore presentation of the Ace Collins interview with the stories behind Christmas songs and traditions from the number of books that he has published, all with Zondervan Publishing House. He also has a number of novels. Be sure to check out his website, acecollins.com. You can also hear this interview again, if you'd like, on our website, wtbfradio.com, or on my podcast, onthebookshelf.podbean.com. So for the staff and management here at Troy Broadcasting Corporation, I'd like to wish all of you a very Merry Christmas. May we hold tight to the joys of the season. May we remember whose birthday it is and why we celebrate it. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening. God bless. And again, Merry Christmas.